As I told the people, the newcomers in the village this afternoon, I always begin one of these things by asking if there are any questions. That does a couple of things. First of all, if you're a good teacher, you should always leave time for questions, and so that leaves time for questions. Secondly,
I have a question, sir.
Yeah.
What are these people doing over here?
We're mopping up after Rich Kamer.
Before Rich Kamer.
We're not after Rich Kamer yet. You're mopping up during Rich Kamer. The second reason for asking for questions at the beginning is that there usually aren't any, except for smart alecky students and things like that. There usually aren't questions at the beginning, and so I will have done my duty as a good teacher, but still left all the time for myself to do with whatever I wish. I should have thought, however, that for those of you that have read the board, in fact, maybe there are so many of you here because most of you haven't read the board. But if you have read the board, I should have thought that you would have had at least one question. What are you talking about? What do you mean by art and incarnation? I can't imagine, except maybe here at Holden, why anybody would want at this time of the evening to go to a room and listen to a topic based on the theme art and incarnation, unless you think we're going to talk about pet food or a special kind of powdered milk, and what art has to do with that in a new art form, or if I'm not throwing a party, you understand. I'm dead serious. Or unless you're really curious to know what incarnation means, in which case you should ask. you really should ask, and I would hope that these kinds of sessions, the reason that we have gathered around is because this is not intended to really be a dissertation or a thesis. It's the sharing of some ideas, and my particular ideas come out of my experience as artist and not out of my experience as a theologian, which is nil, or as a philosopher, which is even niller. Can you get nil, niller, nillist? No. I think you know what I mean. Or my experience as an orator, which is nillist. I really am going at this as one who is involved in the relationship, I mean, deeply committed to the relationship of the making of art things within the framework of the body of Christ. That sounds heavy, and it isn't. It takes a guy, I guess, like Leo, to make some comment about the fact that within the structure, and I should qualify which particular structure I'm in. I'm Missouri Synod. There is still room for hilarity, and I feel that maybe even more than ever, now might be the time. I may have to get it from somewhere else, but if I can find it, I'd like to bring it to where I am. That I would not like to make this also a history lesson. because I am not a historian. I think, however, it would be really nice to think of the possibilities of there being a viable, whatever that means, an exciting, a hilarious, a celebrating relationship between the creative arts and the church. And I somehow get the impression that this whole relationship has broken down. It may have always been broken down. I mean, this relationship between art and the church may have always been walking a very tight line. I know for a fact that whenever we have art discussions here with people of an evening or an after or the morning, that we get really very, very uptight, and all, you know, especially us people who have a few words to say about art. You know, we got, you know, if any of you can put plastic juxtaposition into a sentence, you know, throw that out and come down heavy with it on somebody else who is talking about, you know, the stained surface or minimal art and things of that sort. But the language that people throw around in defense of or in rejection of art is probably harder among church people than it is anywhere else. I sit now on 17 building committees, if you can imagine that. One of them is traumatic. Any one of them. Pick one of them, and it's almost, I can't imagine purgatory being worse than a church building committee. But 17 of them, you know, you walk into Emmaus and you call it Trinity, and all of a sudden you've lost everybody. Or you can do anything you want with our new remodeling program, Kemmerer. Just don't touch Jesus walking on the water over the altar, which is the ugliest, the stupidest, just absolute total disaster. Doing a church for Lafayette, Indiana, which is an okay town, and they've got churches in Lafayette that are 100 years old, 150 years old, and I just finished before I came. It was a picture of Christ preaching on the Sermon on the Mount, and it was to cover an old picture which had just fallen apart. And they had been painting around this picture for decades. And it was on paper. And it was a pastel version of Christ with his elbows on the rock, praying in the Garden of Gethsemane. And it was done by an absolutely beautiful person, I'm sure, with no talent whatsoever. It was criminal, absolutely criminal, and the congregation had turned it into an icon. I was not allowed to paint on the wall to cover the thing. I had to stretch a piece of canvas on a stretcher which went to a point that was, came to a point and came out like this. It fitted into a niche, 9.5 feet across the bottom and 11 feet tall. A huge painting. And it had to be on a stretcher, because if they didn't like what I painted, they could always lift it off. And this bearded lady would be underneath. How do I do that? The light?
There you go. It's
like somebody said about Abraham Lincoln, you could make anybody look like Abraham Lincoln, but you couldn't make Abraham Lincoln look like anybody. you know, anybody could look like Jesus, I guess, if you worked hard at it. And you just slap a little beard on there and slap a mustache, give him a big puffy lip and long hair, and throw a thing over the shoulder so that you can't see armpit, and tie a sash around there and put a silver plate behind his head, and that's it. That, you know, that's all it takes. And more rot guts has been thrown at more people in the name of religious art, I think, than I think more rot gut in the name of religious art than rot gut in the name of religious theology, even. Or preaching, even. And as a result, I think probably we have become so saturated, so inundated, that we don't care anymore. We just really don't care. And I got a hunch that in the history of art and the relationship of the church, just as people can choose the church of their choice now, I mean the one that makes them feel okay, you know, it's like going to a car dealer. You can get your Jesus with whatever accessories you want. You know, I mean, he can have a padded dash if you want, you know. He can be automatic or you can shift him. You know, really. And if the church doesn't do it right, then you go to another dealer. They don't have that particular model, you know. You just swap. Go to someplace else. And it's the same way with the art. You take away that image and you take away my Jesus. And the image was given to them by some klutz like me, you know, by an artist. And it has become the Christ. And it won't change. I guess I was reading, I've been reading the history of the church. And I guess it, one of the most interesting parts of the history of the church is the part that has to do with how the early church, and well, the church altogether, has had dealings with images. People have died. People have been maimed. People have been branded. A fleet was sent from Greece to Constantinople to try and overthrow Byzantium because Byzantium said, no images. And Greece says, images are okay. And so they set out to destroy Byzantium during the iconoclastic controversy. Two brothers, two monks, who were for the making of images, had emblazoned on their forehead with branding irons statements to deny the making of images. I mean, they were like cattle. These things were like, it was curved to fit around. The head was shaved, and it was like, thou shalt not make images. And they went through the rest of their lives with that on their heads. I might say they went through the rest of their lives with that on their heads, making icons. Making icons. Well, the early church, I think, had virtually nothing to do with images. Almost nothing to do as an official church with images. They were really scared of them. You had three things happening. You had Jews, you had Greeks, and you had Romans. And these were all kind of interchanged. And the Jews, of course, had a whole history of no graven images. And when it came time for the Christ thing, they were so into their no image thing that they just kind of kept it going. But even the Jewish people had this back and forth. There are probably more exceptions, like my good old friend, God bless him, an old Jew, Benshan, who said there are more exceptions to that rule among us Jews than there are the examples of how it was followed. And talking last night with Dr. Bainton late into the evening about the beautiful synagogue at Dura, with all of the most marvelous images.
Not of God. Not of God.
But of virtually everything else. Everything else under the sun that you could think of. And as soon as you got to a point where there were images that were accepted, other people started saying, you're paying too much attention to the images. Now cut that out. Our faith is a faith of the Spirit and not of matter. And so you had a for and you had an against. And they just didn't say, let's live together. And the for people will have the synagogue at Dura. The against people will have a whitewashed square room like they used to, the beautiful ones in Spain, for example. No! I mean, they went down on one another with all kinds of law. They started quoting Old Testament right and left. And when the new church came along, it was the same kind of thing. I think Dr. Bainton would be most interested. I probably, what am I talking? He probably wrote a book already about it. The fact that the image business really started very, very strongly and helped the whole creation of early Christian iconography in the East, and it was due primarily to women. To women who were more responsible, mainly because it got started not in the in the big official ways, but in the home. In the home. Just show you a couple of examples of art and the relationship to the church. I'm going to rip through these very quickly. I have very few, and I'll even show them two at a time. To give you an idea of how art from time to time has related to the church. All 17 of those congregations that I'm working with asked one thing. Every other way they were different, but one thing they all wanted: give us a church that looks like a church. And I didn't know what they meant. I hadn't the vaguest idea what they meant. And so I started out showing them a picture of a catacomb. No, 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 no. Not that church, you dummy, you know. Yeah, these guys coming from small towns in northern Indiana don't even know what a church looks like, you know. So I would show them the Hagia Sophia, you know. 275 feet high. No, 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 you clutch. What kind of a budget do you think we got here, you know? Why, our what we got in mind could swing around inside that building like a clapper in a bell. No, no, no. A small church that looks like a church. That looks like a what? Church. Well, how about a Gothic cathedral, huh? A small little church, maybe for about 85 thou, with a four-rank organ that looks like a Gothic cathedral. Somebody went to France and came back to Kansas and said, in the middle of our wheat field, we got to have what a church really looks like. If the tradition of the church were really followed, if it were absolutely followed faithfully, we would have to find something which was relevant to our own time
and to our own place. We would have to not just find it, we'd have to invent it. If I can just show you one thing tonight, it's going to be that the history of the relationship of art to the church through iconoclastic controversy, iconoclasm, what a word, the smashing of images, to those who accept the image as a viable way of conveying the Christ message. Okay, if there's one thing that really all of those things have in common, it's that they don't have anything in common. Now, I think it would actually be better if I went through this pretty fast so that you can see the kind of changes that went on. These are very early. Over here we've got something from Jerusalem. In fact, this is one of the first souvenirs. This is a postcard that folks could take back to wherever they came from that says, "Hey, Ma, we made it to the holy city. We got it, and I can prove it. I got this little flask, and this flask has oil in it, and the oil was burning at the rotunda of the Anastasis." Can you imagine that? Honest to God oil burning at the honest to God place where the honest to God rose. Fantastic. And I'm going to take it home, and it's going to have a picture of a Syrian prophet hanging on a cross. On account of the guy that made this was a Syrian prophet. You talk about making things in your own image. One of the early church fathers who was really anti-icon said a beautiful thing. I'm not in his camp, but I sure liked some of the things he said. And he said, "If cows and horses and dogs could make icons, we would have icons that look like cows and horses and dogs. And the image of God would be a cow, or a horse, or a dog. But man makes icons. And so the image of God is a man." That's a little heavy. That's frightening. It just makes you wonder when women are going to get into the icon making business. They're going to throw the whole thing, you know, into a cocked hat. It's going to be a disaster. But, okay, we got this coming out of the Middle East, and we got this coming out of the West. They had the same idea. They wanted to talk about the resurrection. And the best way of talking about the resurrection was to include a little image of the rotunda of the Anastasis, the little building that they built over where Christ rose. Here's one, here it is, there's the other one. Little rotunda. Whenever you saw that little picture of the rotunda, you said, "Ah, resurrection." That's what's going on there. It's going on in both of these things, but look at the Christ over there. It's Apollo. It's a beardless youth shaking hands with God the Father. Now this is in Dr. Bainton's book, and you really ought to get that book. I think there may be a couple copies left over in the bookstore, on the Faces of Christ. It's really a remarkable and beautiful book. You ought to pick it up and have him sign it. He'll paint your picture on the fly leaf, I'm sure, and you'll have a treasure all your days. But he talks about this particular image over there really as being a portrait of the ascension that takes place in a kind of resurrection motif. I'm going to fight him a little bit on that. I think it's kind of a victory handshake. I don't think that he's ascending up into heaven in that particular picture. I got a hunch that he is just simply celebrating his victory as any Apollo would do after he rose from the dead. But the point is, the image that's being made is in the image of the Maker. It's in the image of the Maker that in Italy you just are not going to have for your God, whether he hung on a cross
or stood on Olympus, you're not going to have this barefooted, Syrian, long-bearded, mustachioed prophet in this dumb robe. He's going to have to float a little, and he's going to have to look like he descended from one of the deities. So already, the early Christians are saying, what we've got, you know, what we've got to make our images out of is what we know. Huh. The whole scene shifts. The whole early church goes east. Great big split. And you can look at any art you want to, and it will mark a division line somewhere. It will stand between something. Van Gogh stands on an edge between the Academy and the Expressionists. You know, anybody will stand in the history of art on this edge. This is another edge, and it was one of the most incredible times, incredible places. And it was when Constantine moved the whole church from Rome over to Constantinople. Constantinople, on the edge all by itself, just sitting there, it's on the edge, half in Europe and half in Asia. The Asian half being a little part of the town they call Üsküdar. And the art that comes out is half European and half Asian. And the struggling between the Eastern Church and the Western Church is a struggle not just between, you know, where you want to have the capital of the church. It's between people that were born and raised differently, that had whole concepts of the relationship between themselves and their maker different. Their theologies were different. The thing they had in common was the Christ. And when it came time to making the images, the whole nation got split on that. So they had these outposts of Byzantium in Greece. They had them in Italy, in Ravenna. They had them down in Sicily. And they had them in Turkey, what's now Turkey. And each one of these little outposts viewed the making of images different. You absolutely cannot make a picture of Christ. In no way can you make a picture of Christ. Gee, why can't I? Because God, the Son, is two natures. And if you paint a picture of Christ, you're going to paint his human nature, and you will deny his divine nature, and therefore you are not following the creed of the early church fathers. That's why not. And on the other side, you had a guy that says, yeah, but the way I am painting it is in a way denying the human substance of the Son. It is both body and soul. It is epiphanous. It is vision. The image does not take place in reality. It takes place in a vision. And thus I am bringing to this image both the divine nature and the human nature. Oh, did they get into fights? There was an edict that was passed. I wish I could remember, you know, history and something. In the middle of the 500s, one guy stood up at a council and said, absolutely, you will not make an image. I don't care what St. Paul says, let everybody do according to his own gifts. You artists are exempt. No kidding, in so many words. Anybody could do according to what they knew and how they knew to do it, except the artist. And he went so far, this one bishop, who must have been a real schwanz, he said, I mean, as an artist, I say, he must have been a real schwanz. He said, I deem the painting of an abacus as being heresy. I deem the carving of a cabinet as being the same as the making of an idol. I mean, that did not leave a whole lot of stuff for the artist to do, you know. I mean, what do they do that is not idolatrous? It went into an incredible list of stuff that was absolutely prohibited to the artist. And from the East, there came the images. And pretty soon, Justinian at a council made a great law. And the artists that worked for the church were accepted. In fact, he not only said it's okay, he says, you're all going to do it, and every house is going to have one. Punct. That's all she wrote. Now, a whole theology then of images came about. And boy, we have suffered under this for centuries. When is the reverencing of an image idolatrous, and when is it not? You see, the Roman emperors had images. In fact, the successor to Pontius Pilate, he comes down to Jerusalem. He's got to get to Jerusalem. Pilate's been dead now. We got to have another head man down there. And this guy's got birds. He's got eagles on standards. And on the eagle's bosom is a big picture of the emperor. And this guy has got to maneuver his way. The map of this guy's trip into the Holy Land is a riot. He's got to maneuver his way around the Hebrew settlements so that they are not offended by his images, by the images on his pole. Incredible thing. That's how really important this was, so that they are not offended by his images, by the images on his pole. Incredible thing. That's how really important this was. But the images grew, and they grew in the home, and the women more than any were responsible for it. And the theology of images grew, and you had this pro and this con. And the theology of the image went something like this. We try very hard for a consistency. In fact, the great Byzantine word was consistency. If you look at a Byzantine icon that was done around 500, and a Byzantine icon that was done in Russia in the late 19th century, you would find such a consistency as to just blow your mind. It never happened before except in one place, and that was Egypt. That kind of consistency. We will start with the image of Christ, with what we know from all good accounts to be the Christ. And we will make this image so as to convey the real reality of Christ, the dual, both God and man, reality of Christ, and of Mary, and of the saints. And therefore, the reality of Christ in an image will remind us of our responsibilities, will do for us very much the same thing as the Christ if he were standing in front of us. We will develop a pious demeanor. The icon will be as it was in Rome when the emperor sent his image into all of the frontiers, into all of the outposts of the Roman Empire, and there, the image was as the emperor. It was honored as the emperor. It was the emperor in that place. As a result, you've got a thing here that's going on with the jewels and all of that business, which is an understanding of an image which is very much sacramental. The Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. The Word Jesus Christ becomes matter, bone, skin, nail, hair, all of that stuff. And in the process of working out our salvation, God takes the Word and gives it flesh, enfleshes the Word. In addition, our salvation is also worked out in grace and wheat and water, the things of the earth. That whole business is what we call the theology of the Incarnation. And so it was the theology of the Incarnation that the artists used, who were priests, by the way. And it was the theology of the Incarnation that was understood by the people who lived in Byzantium at this time, and could understand the nature of that image very much like we understand the nature of a hunk of bread when it is pushed down our gullet and we confess that that is the body of Christ. Or the little slug of manischewitz that we gulp down, and that is the blood of Christ. Here was a whole arena, a whole community that understood the nature of the Incarnation in a way that I don't think anyone else ever understood it before that or since then. It governed the whole life, the whole politics, the whole social structure of the Byzantine community. And not of the entire Byzantine community. Of course, the church was divided, and even Byzantium was divided. And where these images hung on most of all was in Greece. Why in Greece? Because Greece was used to images. Greece had had images for ever since the archaic times. They were accustomed to God taking on the form of an image. Everywhere else, it became really a disaster, the relationship between the image makers and the non-image makers. There was always a special distinction made between the reverence one gives for the delegates of Christ and the reverence that one gives to Christ himself. They were not confused. They were not the same thing. The icons, the images for Byzantium, even extended to non-images, places. The place where Christ rose from the dead was an icon. They called it the iconography of place. And they had a whole hierarchy of icons which had nothing to do with images. If you go to Jerusalem now, you're going to wind up with Armenians pulling on one coattail and Jesuits pulling on another, and they're all going to try and tell you that X marks the real spot. X, this, our X is the X you want to go to. If you go over to their X, I'm telling you, my boy, you are going to have to pay good money, and you're going to have to throw something into the tomb. Now you come over to my X. I'm not going to show you no plastic, no marble around the rock. I'm going to show you the honest rock. I am going to show you a for true rock, and not only that, you are not going to have to spend no money, and you are going to get a blessing. I'm going to sprinkle you with water. Now you come over here. You come around. Don't go in there. You come around to the back. The rock is not covered. Boy, I tell you, after a day in the holy city of seeing the Virgin Mary's one true kitchen cupboard, of seeing, the one true woman and the one true well, all these X's, Gethsemane, that was the spot. Look at the knees right there. They put down into the ground. There were the knee things down there. I kept telling him the guy was from the Middle East. He probably didn't kneel. He probably laid himself flat on his belly, like a Middle Easterner ought to do. Or you know, you go up to the Mount of Olives. There's a little mosque. You go crawling up there, and there is, under the mosque, there's a strange culture shock there. Under the mosque, there is a rock, and the rock's got two footprints in it. That's where he went up. He took off from there. And it must have been a rainy day, because he left his footprints there in that solid rock. And you begin to say, oh, come on, will you lay off with your X marks the spot jazz, you know. What is this hokey souvenir? I go down the Via Dolorosa, you know, and all these guys sticking, you're number six, you're number seven, you're number 14, you know. You don't want to do the Via Dolorosa without a number 14. It's the last stop here, you know, the best souvenirs. Number one, St. Anne's Church. Well, none of that was what you had back in Concordia Maplewood, Kimmerer. In the vacation Bible school. On account of what you had back there was Jesus walking 6 inches off the ground, you know. And little children were following him, and they were 6 inches off the ground too, you know. Anybody who followed Jesus was 6 inches off the ground. And all the disciples, especially that stinky, dumb kid, John, who always went around with his head on one shoulder, just, oh, you know, I'd just like to take John and hit him upside the head. Straighten up, John. You know, you're going to get crooked going through the rest of your life leaning over like that. You know, he's going to take off, and John's going to be walking around like this with nobody to lean on, you know. Oh, you're so lovey, you know. And the Sons of Thunder, Boanerges. I think going to get in a big fight over who sits on the right and who sits on the left. Sons of Thunder. And they all look like wimps. You know? Really super sweet. And you go, and it's smelly in Jerusalem. I mean, Jesus and his 12 guys could be walking past you, and you got to say to yourself, how would I know? How would I know? No wonder. No wonder he only wound up with 12 guys at the end of his ministry. This place is a hole. This is the armpit of the world. But St. Helen, she goes over there like crazy, right after, and she runs over there, and she says, bleh, where the cross went into the ground, and where he was buried in the tomb. And you go over there, and you say, oh my God, where the cross was buried into the ground, where the tomb, and it doesn't make sense to anything you have ever learned. And we got to the Mount of Olives, we stayed. Can you imagine the Mount of Olives Hotel? Every morning from the mosque next door. You know, I mean, oh my golly, I got to get over there and see them footprints. You know, we sat on the roof of the Mount of Olives Hotel on that Sunday morning, and we said, damn the tourists. Damn the Armenians, damn the Catholics, damn the whole city of Jerusalem, this thing stinks. And what we were really saying is, the problem was not X marks the spot. The problem was, if I ever knew for sure where the X really went, based on what I know to be true, would I believe at all? Would I really believe at all? And we had on that Sunday morning a whole Eucharist on the roof of the Mount of Olives Hotel that was like nothing I have ever seen in my life. 38 people crying and weeping and saying, Lord, I believe. Help thou mine unbelief. I know there is an X
around here somewhere. Iconography of place. It is in your gut. Or it certainly was in the gut of people that said there is a sacrament to the earth, to the ground on where our faith took root, came down, not just onto the earth, but wound up in a cave. And I'm sorry that the guys went into that cave and hung all of their little strange lanterns and sell all of their icky pooey postcards. Somewhere in that cave is where my faith is grounded. And it is an iconography of place. Of place. Now, if you could get that far, if you had a place that was the navel of your faith, if you really knew how that operated, I'll bet you, for one thing, we'd be more sympathetic to what's going on in the Middle East right now. I mean, why are the people fighting over that scruffy plot of ground when they, whoever wins, what are they going to get? Nothing, you know. Oh, no. It is part of the ground of their being. Most of us don't have a place like that. And it is out of that sense of place that the images and the icons came. Okay. I'm going too slow. But look what they did with their icons. This was the Virgin Mary. That was not a picture. That was the Virgin Mary. And if the Virgin Mary had been walking in front of them, they wouldn't have gone up and draped jewels all over her. They would have had more respect. To lay velvet all over the Holy Mother, give her nice little slippers with curly toes and rhinestones and jewels, and hang all that gold-plated stuff around her neck, there's no way that they would have treated the Virgin Mary that way. But this is the Virgin Mary in their midst. It is for them the representative of the Virgin Mary, and they revere it in a way that they could not revere the Virgin. Such times change so quickly, and I wouldn't dream of, I'd just like to spend some time with you of an evening talking about the Dark Ages and show you what Attila the Hun did for Christian art. We wouldn't have had Gothic cathedrals if it hadn't been for Attila the Hun. Or if we had, we would have had them in a different form. You wouldn't have recognized them. The Vikings threw their stuff in, all kinds of people migrating across the East and the West, added little contributions. But come the year 1000 and the millennium didn't show up, Jesus didn't come down in a fiery ball and the earth was not consumed, and people said, wow, holy cow, we have not done any building in the last 4 years, God, on account of we thought, you know, it was all going to get wiped out. So maybe we ought to start it up. And so they waited for the year 1004 just to make sure that their calendar and God's calendar were the same calendar. And then they said, let's go. St. Michael is not coming. We are living under the judgment, but we are living in grace. And they built cathedrals, one monk said, like mushrooms popping up all over the landscape. And they were started by the monastic community, and Christ in judgment stood over the throne. But these people, as they walked under that throne of judgment, also came into a sense of delight. This is Romanesque and it's heavy. These are the Ein Feste Burg, you know, these great big castle-like buildings that they called churches. They pour boiling oil from the parapets down on the Christmas carolers and things like that, you know. Really heavy, bulky, cold kinds of things. And inside, oh,
a little fellow by the name of Gizelberti, one of the first guys in the history of Christian art to give his name to what he did. All the rest were leaving handprints in the masonry. Gizelbertus predated Michelangelo, and he wrote it down there. Gizelbertus, oh, yeah, I did it, and nobody else did it. And he was ahead of his time in more ways than one. Eve, going through foliage of abstract. This stuff is right off of the manuscript of the Dark Ages, flat. But she is forth. She is a Shainstabae. She is lovely. And she has assumed the form of a serpent already. And she has sinned and is reaching back. She's not even going to look at the apple. She knows already she has done wrong. Look at her. Two different people. An innocent, a ponderer, a temptress, a tantalizer. I'm going to take this little thing over to Adam. Incredible. A guy around the time of nothing. We had him in the Dark Ages in our history books a couple years ago. And he sticks that personality, that sense of the humanness of all kinds of theological humanness. And funny, Leo would invite Gizelbertus to his party. The angel. First of all, you got three wise men sleeping under the same blanket. You know. I do not know what Gizelbertus was trying to tell us. All I know is that one of the guys had his arm outside the blanket so that the angel could touch him. And the angel touches the little finger of the one wise man, and it opens his eye. Oh, my gosh, the linear thing going from the hand of the angel to the hand of the wise men to the eye. I mean, it's split second. There's a time thing going on. The wise man hasn't even gotten up. He has said, "Who got my finger?" I can just... Is that you, Balthazar? No, huh? Oh man, there's four of us in this room. Is that you, Herod? And Mary, on the donkey, holding her kid on her, not even on her lap, plastered up against her side, and it's a long trip, and Gizelbertus has given the donkey wheel. Oh, you gotta love that. A donkey with wheels for the flight to Egypt. Now, that is marvelous. The sense of delight, the sense of pure joy, the being under the judgment and yet free of the judgment. And what you have is, everybody calls this Gothic age the age of faith. No. Oh, no. By the time they got there to the Gothic age, they knew how to build a cathedral. Every now and then they built one too high and it fell down, you know. Every now and then. But most of the engineering had pretty well been mapped out in the Romanesque age. The Romanesque age, that was the age of faith, and the Gothic was the age of piety. And by the time you get to these places in the Gothic age, they are so full of the delight that they inherited from the Romanesque people. Their stone they painted to look like the vaults of heaven. Light. Everything destroyed. Matter. There was no There was no separating what came down and what went up. The cathedral starts out of the ground and it goes into nothing. It evaporates into light and glass, and the hand of God comes down, and you cannot tell where one begins and the other ends. And the theology of the incarnation is told in a completely different manner. Not a better one. There is no way that you can get that stuff out of Northern Europe. The Italians tried for centuries to get Gothic down. First, they were the guys that called it Gothic. And Gothic had been dead as an ethnic term for 600 years. And it was like saying Neanderthal, barbaric. And then it got popular, and the Italians said, well, we better lay on some Gothic down here. And they couldn't do it. If Gothic, at the time it was done, had been the official, the best way of solving the problems of the church, Rome would be the most Gothic city in the world. It's probably the least. Boston has better Gothic architecture than Rome does. No, it's a northern phenomenon. You couldn't have had it without the Vikings. You couldn't have had it without the Goths, the Visigoths, the way they laid the little color inside the enamel and did all that cloisonné, the bridle bits, the saddles, all of that stuff. It got big, it got big, it got bigger, and it turned into the dissolution of time and form and space. Until the whole thing was glass. And then it was time for Giotto. And Giotto says, we have gotten so much into the spirit, whatever happened to man? And he gets into his angels, and he gives his angels human qualities, something that the Byzantine people would never do. A Byzantine angel is standing there with the orb in front, looking like it's going to chop you right in half if you turn right when you should turn left. And Mary is sitting there with a baby in her lap, and he's 40 years old, and he's got 5 o'clock shadow. And he is ready to come down on your case as Pantocrator from the lap of the Virgin. But not Giotto. Giotto talks to us like St. Francis talks to us. And the whole thing of God is that he loved us not up there. It is not theophany. It is not just simply a revelation. It is not only epiphanous. God works in front of blue sky. And Giotto said, once again, let there be blue sky. Let's get rid of the gold and create, recreate how God operates with us in human terms. Well, eventually that becomes so human that it's kind of hard to tell our God from all the other gods. And they sit on the great thrones, and they make great pronunciations, and we're not really sure whether we are on top of Olympus or approaching the throne of heaven. And we somehow left our Jesus. Well, it seems to me that in this time and in this place, there has got to be a whole raft of people who are concerned and who are interested in how God lives in and among and under his people now. It's almost like a fool's mission in our time to try and draw the image of Christ so that he makes any sense to us now. Being a fool, I've decided that that's my mission. And the Good Shepherd is not a bearded lady. The Good Shepherd is like a mountain. It's like a quarry, so that the sheep is not dangling by a thread, but is protected in a cave that is a shelter. And Christ dies on the front of our daily newspaper. He is resurrected out of the middle of ghettos and inner cities, and he sits at our lunch counters. And somewhere there is a Christ that we can build a shawl for, that we can build a priestly vestment for, and stick and tack and nail and paste everything of what we are onto that shawl and just throw it over the shoulder of Christ as he dances on the cross and say, "You betcha, there is a Christ that dances for us right here and now." Thanks.